Well, 72 years our foremothers fought just to win us our right at the ballot box. But even then they knew that the fight had just begun, and their daughters will not rest until equality is won. We will not stop, we will not go away. We will not stop, we will not go away.
I'm your host, Marguerite Kearns, for Votes for Women's Salon. I found that when women understand how difficult it was to win the right to vote, their attitudes change about participating in the political process. Today's guest is Jerry Grebe, musician, historian, and educator. She's been performing songs from women's experience and history for over 25 years. Jerry's song, We Will Not Stop, We Will Not Go Away, introduces our Votes for Women's Salon series. It reminds us of the many years it took to win the vote and how we're still interpreting the work begun back in 1776 by our country's founders. Jerry, I'm interested in what got you started on the path of researching and sharing women's music. I grew up knowing about my grandmother Edna's suffrage campaign wagon that was stored in my grandfather's garage, and every summer my mother took photos of us kids sitting in the wagon. But finding out more about my grandmother and the other brave suffragists has become a calling for me, much like performing women's music has been a calling for you. Can you describe some of the songs you include in your programs and the romp through musical history, and tell me if there's ever a time in your career when you doubted the importance of the work you're doing?
Those are two broad questions. let me try to address best I can. I became interested in women's folk songs in my early 20s. I went to college in the early 1970s, and I graduated in 1976, which was the bicentennial. So that was a period when there was a lot of interest in taking a look at history of more common people, you know, as opposed to just kings and queens and presidents and people like that. So there was a lot of research at the time going into women's history and African American history and Native American history. And when I was in college, we got a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to create two courses in women's history. And the first course covered world women's history from prehistoric times to 1815. I can't remember why 1815 was the cutoff date, but it was. And then the second course was U.S. women's history. So the whole world of women's history was considered to be able to be covered in two courses. Unfortunately, as soon as the grant ran out, those courses disappeared. But I did manage to take the one in women's history, and it was such a life-changing experience, because it had never occurred to me that all the history that I had studied in grade school and high school and even in college up till that point was basically just the history of what men were doing, and women were just kind of assumed to be along for the ride, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And that was when I first heard about the women's suffrage movement. I knew women could vote, but I didn't know when this had happened, you know, when this had started, because in the history books I'd always used in high school or whatever, the chapters were pretty much just delineated by the wars, and we had the Civil War, and then we had World War I, and then we moved into the Roaring Twenties. And it was just kind of taken for granted that somewhere in that period, women had gotten the right to vote. And so that was the first thing that started my mind wandering down this path. Then after I left college, I worked for the Cincinnati Historical Society. And one of my jobs there was to put together different exhibits. And I decided to put together an exhibit on women's suffrage. And one of the surprises I got is that as I was going through all the manuscripts and ephemera, I wasn't finding anything in the collections in support of women's suffrage, but I was finding a lot from anti-women's suffrage, because as it turned out, the Cincinnati area was a very conservative area, and many of the major women's groups there opposed women's suffrage. So I put together a display on anti-women's suffrage, because that was a good way to talk about suffrage. Then, as I moved on through life, I had always been singing folk songs. I grew up in a family that did a lot of singing, and I'm from an area where, you know, folk music is quite common. And I was living in Wisconsin by this point, and I was performing at a folk festival, and they had a workshop called Women Folk. and they asked me to be on this panel. And in the brochure, it said these would be all songs by and about women. And the first surprise I got is that I got to the women's folk panel, and I was the only woman on the women folk panel. All of the other panelists were men. And as we did kind of a round-robin singing, I realized that all the songs that the men were singing were songs that had been written by men about women's experience. And don't get me wrong, they were wonderful songs about, you know, domestic violence or whatever, but they were all written by Utah Phillips and, you know, Cy Conn and people like that. And every time we got down to me, I was singing traditional songs. These are songs that we don't know who wrote them. They've just come down through the tradition for, you know, 200 years. But they're about women's experiences. And I realized that all the songs I knew or all the songs I'd ever heard that were from a woman's point of view told one of two stories. They were either about young women who, unable to get the man they loved to marry them, went down to the river and drowned themselves, or they were stories about women who, having married the man they loved, found out he wasn't the peach that they were expecting him to be, so they went down to the river and drowned themselves.
Right.
And so that was just, I think, a moment where it was like being struck by a bolt of lightning. And pulling together, you know, my experience in college and what an eye-opening experience that was. And I decided that right then and there, I want to find one song to work into my repertoire that showed a woman, a traditional song, not a song that I was going to write about, you know, Rosie the River or Sojourner or Truth. I wanted to find a song that came out of the folk tradition that showed women doing something else. And the first song that I found was one called Equinoxial and Phoebe. And this is a song in which a husband and wife who are working a farm swap roles for the day. And by the end of the day, he's singing that Phoebe could do more work in a day than he could do in seven. And I thought, ah, that's a woman positive song. You know, that shows something that, you know, in the course of the song, he does all of her chores while she's out plowing, which is, you know, typically his job. And, you know, the pig runs away from him and he hits his head on the beam as he's trying to milk the cow, and the chickens run away and the butter catches on fire, you know, and all these disasters. And that's why he's singing at the end, you know, Phoebe could do more work in a day than he could do in seven. So I went from finding that one song to just becoming obsessed with it. And I made several trips to Washington, D.C., to the Library of Congress to listen to old field recordings. I started spreading the word to anybody who would listen that, you know, I want songs that are woman positive. You know, she doesn't die in the end. She doesn't kill herself. She doesn't. When I decided that I wanted to do a whole program of women's songs instead of just, you know, working this one song into my repertoire, one of the gold mines of songs that I found were songs written for the suffrage movement. Now, the fight for women to have equal rights to men goes way back to the 1630s. You know, there was a woman, Mary Dyer, who was hanged in 1660 because she was preaching in Boston, and that was just, you know, unheard of. And, of course, there's the famous story of Abigail Adams entreating her husband John to remember the ladies in the new codes of law that they're writing back in 1776. And, unfortunately, the ladies, you know, were not remembered. But it was a long period of little bitty gains, you know, that some women might get a right to vote because they own land, but they would quickly, you know, lose it. In fact, in some of the colonies, women had the right to vote before the American Revolution because they were landowners, and they lost that right. So it was a slow process of in 1838 in Kentucky, widowed women with children got the right to vote in school board elections because that was deemed as, you know, a proper place for women. They should have a say in, you know, what was happening with their children in schools. So, you know, this very, very slow process of little bits and pieces here and there. But the suffrage movement that we talk about in terms of like your grandmother's suffrage wagon, that kicked into high gear after the Civil War. because many of the women who were later to be involved in the women's suffrage movement had also been involved in the anti-slavery movement. And after the Civil War and after the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendment, in which black men got the right to vote, but women did not, that's when the suffrage movement that we think of today, you know, with a capital S, that's when that kicked into high gear.
How important was music in the suffrage movement?
Many of the meetings and the rallies were patterned on what women would have been familiar with in different religious organizations. And so from the very start, when they would have a meeting, they might open with a prayer and open with a song, because that would just be a traditional way of doing it. So they would take songs that everybody knew, you know, popular tunes like Auld Lang Syne or America or whatever, and they would write suffrage words to go with that song. And they might print those words in with the, you know, the meeting agenda, so that everybody could sing it together. So that was one way that they would use a song as a way to open a meeting and get everybody on the same page, you know, get everybody in the spirit. They would also use them when they were marching, because when you got into the 1890s, that's when the anti-suffrage movement really kicked into high gear. And there's, you know, I could go into the reasons why that happened, but when the anti-suffrage movement kicked into high gear, and the suffrage movement, especially under the guidance of Alice Paul and the National Women's Party, they took it more to the streets. And it's like with any civil rights movement, which is what the suffrage movement was, when you're out marching in the street, that's a dangerous place to be. And singing helps to create this wall, this feeling of unity. And so, again, they could take songs that everybody knew, and they could print them up in songbooks, and then people could march along, and they could all be singing the same song, even though they'd never heard this song before. And the wonderful thing for somebody like me, who's out there trying to catch these songs, is that these little booklets still exist. You can find these in the Library of Congress, and you can find these in state historical societies, because they'll be with, as I said, you know, agendas of meetings. And so, unlike all the other folk songs I was singing, where they were basically coming down to me orally, these were printed. And so that made my job a lot easier, you know, to pass these along.
Do you have a favorite one that you like, or is there one on your CD?
There is one that I recorded on my CD called Oh Dear, What Can the Matter Be? And that was a popular parlor tune, again, that everybody would have known, but the words to it address an argument that was made against women's suffrage. And there were many arguments against women's suffrage. You know, one of them was that, you know, politics was a dirty place to be and women shouldn't be soiling their hands there. But one argument that people who would say, oh, I think women are smart enough to vote and I think they can handle it, but the bottom line would be, why should they bother? Their husband already votes, their brother already votes, their son already votes. So their needs are being met. They don't need to vote. And so, Oh Dear, What Can the Matter Be? L. Mae Wheeler, who said quite a few songs to, you know, suffrage tunes, wrote this song and took a little turn on it. Oh dear, what can the matter be? Dear, dear, what can the matter be? Oh dear, what can the matter be? Women are wanting to vote. Now, right there, she's poking fun at the whole idea. You know, what's the big deal? Women are wanting to vote. You know, the argument that why should they bother? Well, you could flip that on the other side of and say, well, why shouldn't they? So then she goes on to say, women have husbands, they are protected. Women have sons by whom they're directed. Women have fathers, they're not neglected. Why are they wanting to vote? Again, they have everything. Women have homes, there they should labor. Women have children whom they should favor. Women have time to learn of each neighbor. Why are they wanting to vote? I love that. I love that stanza, because talking about, you know, they already have their home, that's where they should work. They already have children, that's who they should be taking care of. And the line about they have time to learn of each neighbor. and then it gets better. Women can dress. They love society. Women have cash with all its variety. Women can pray with sweetest piety. Why are they wanting to vote? They just have it all. And now here comes the persuasive argument, the women answering back. Women have reared all the sons of the brave. Women have shared in the burdens they gave. Women have labored this country to save, and that's why we're going to vote. So I love that ending. And then the final chorus is, oh, dear, what can the matter be, dear? Dear, what can the matter be, oh, dear, what can the matter be? In this final little punchline, why should men get every vote?
Wow, that's a wonderful tune. In fact, I put it in the little documentary I've been making about my grandmother, because it really says so much, and it's a backdrop for the beautiful photograph that the Library of Congress has in the suffrage movement. I mean, the women really knew how to leave a paper trail, for sure. I mean, there's some spectacular photographs that we have of that period. So do you have a favorite?
Oh, yes,
they
knew how to use drama.
Oh, yes, definitely. And marching. It was like very radical for all these women to be out in the streets. They left their kitchens and were out in the streets, and it was sort of like a spectacle. People had to go see it because they didn't quite believe it, that it was happening. Do you know why the story of the passage of the 19th Amendment has been lost for so many years?
I think it's because we take it for granted. And it got taken for granted because it got lost, and it gets lost because we take it for granted. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I think it's because, number one, when people write history books, there's so much focus on war. You know, to this day, you can look at high school history books and they're delineated by, you know, the American Revolution and then the War of 1812 and then the Civil War. And all the events are reported as being, you know, leading up to that war and the aftermath of that war. And that is still something that's very much a part of the American psyche, you know, is that war, you know, and not in any way to disrespect veterans or anything, but that is considered to be, you know, the most honorable thing you can do is die for your country, fight for your country. I think it's also very honorable to live for your country, you know, and to fight to make your country better. But that's not the way that the textbooks see it. And one thing that a lot of people don't know is that the state of Texas pretty much controls what goes into textbooks, because they are the largest purchaser of textbooks. And so when history textbooks for, you know, grade schools or high schools are being revised, it's pretty much the boards of education in the state of Texas that approve them, and that's what ends up being used by all the school systems in the country. And this isn't just some wacko theory that I have. You know, this is pretty common knowledge in the field of education. And in fact, there have been some recent fights going on because some of these school boards have wanted to do things like eliminate any mention of the United Farm Workers, because they don't see that as part of the American story. You know, they feel that shows America in a bad light. And so there was recently a huge campaign to keep Cesar Chavez in, you know, American U.S. history textbooks. So I think one reason is because it isn't seen as that important, and it isn't seen as part of this war-driven narrative of American history, you know. War-driven narrative and manifest destiny, you know, America moving west. Those are the two key things that get approached in textbooks. What the suffrage movement was the fulfillment of the promise of 1776. You know, our forefathers wrote, all men are created equal, and women wanted to be included in that. So I guess that's the other reason that it doesn't get taught much, is there's always been a sense that it isn't right to criticize America, and you really hear that today. I mean, one of the criticisms of, you know, President Obama is that he apologizes for things Americans have done, and that just drives a certain element of Americans crazy, the ones who believe America could never do anything wrong. So to celebrate the women's suffrage movement is to say that women fought all those years to right a wrong, which I guess is a long way of saying, you know, why I think it tends to get lost, because it's righting a wrong, and I think a lot of Americans don't like to think in those terms. I like to think in terms of that's what makes America so wonderful, is the fact that we do have this Constitution that can right wrongs. You know what I'm saying? So that to me is the beauty of the suffrage movement, and why it needs to be taught, because people need to learn not so much that America can never make a mistake, but that America corrects its mistakes, and I think that's much more important.
Yeah. What kind of response do you get from audiences when you put on your women's history programs?
The response I get depends on what the audience is, because I've often joked that I'm laboring under two preconceived notions. First of all, I'm a folk musician, and the word folk musician means different things to different people. To somebody who grew up in the 60s, folk music is Bob Dylan. You know, Judy Collins. That's what they think of as folk music. And so I get this odd response if they're used to thinking of folk music as, you know, Bob Dylan. I've had people say things like, wow, I understood every word you said, which makes me think, what were you expecting? You know, or somebody will say, oh, you have such a, you know, I'm really surprised you have a really beautiful voice. And again, it's like, why would that surprise you? This is what I do for my living. You know, I would hope that I have a decent voice. But then other people think of folk music as, you know, these old moldy ballads that go on forever, and, you know, they were great 200 years ago, but, you know, nobody has the patience to listen to them today. And so, again, they come up and say, wow, I was surprised at how I really enjoyed this. And I also get a reception of, this song reminded me of something from my childhood, or this song took me back, and so, you know, they enjoy it on that level. But then I have this double thing that not only am I doing folk music, which some people might be, you know, a little skeptical about, but I'm doing women's folk music, and people don't know what to expect with that. I always get an absolutely rousing response when I'm playing for a group that's all women. And that can be whether I'm in a women's prison or whether I'm playing for a junior league, which interestingly I have done in the same day, done a concert for the junior league and done a concert for women's prison, you know, on the same day. And it's interesting because people will say to me, you know, oh, you know, did you have to do a completely different program? And I say, no, I did the exact same program. And they laughed in all the same places. They scowled in all the same places, you know, because the music is universal. So when I'm playing for an all-women's group, no matter, you know, whether it's a convention of nuns or whether it's, you know, military, I there are so many places where I can see light bulbs going off over people's heads because the music connects. These stories, you know, a story like Equinoxial and Phoebe, where the husband starts out saying, you know, he wishes he'd been born a woman because women's lives are so easy. You know, she just sits around the house and does nothing all day while he's out in the hot sun plowing the fields. And that's how they end up swapping roles. And at the end of the day, he's realizing that a woman's job is much harder than he thought. Well, when I sing that song, the women in the audience are rolling their eyes because they all know about multitasking. They all know about the fact that, you know, even if they have a full-time job, they're still the one who ends up having to stay on top of, you know, the PTA meeting. They're still the one that's got to get the kids to the soccer game. You know, they know this. And it's interesting because every now and then there's something in the popular media that lets me make a connection. I was in a motel once waiting to, you know, waiting for my gig, and I was watching Dr. Phil. And wouldn't you know it, on Dr. Phil, the story was a woman was complaining about the fact that her husband, she was a stay-at-home mom, and she was complaining that her husband would always come home from work and he'd expect her, you know, to have all this stuff done because, you know, all she's doing is sitting around the house all day. So Dr. Phil sent the woman to a spa for a week and arranged it so that the husband had the week off from work and he stayed home with the kids. And by the end of the week, he was saying he'd rather be at work. And I thought, I don't believe this just dropped into my lap. This is Equinoctial and Phoebe on Dr. Phil. You know, this story is still so relevant. So that night when I did my show, I said, did anybody see Dr. Phil today? And some of them had. So that's kind of fun that you can, you know, make these connections like that. Now, your question was, though, what about when there's men in the audience? And that really depends on what the men are bringing in. And I, in my earlier days, I always wanted to please everybody, which is another very female thing, you know, that we are raised to make everybody happy, you know, and you know, we never, you know, that male ego, boy, we really have to protect that. And so I at first would kind of temper what I was saying, and I would temper what I was singing. And then I decided, no, if I do that, I'm not being fair to the women in the audience. You know, if I pull back and I don't tell about that Dr. Phil story, you know, I'm not being fair to the women in the audience. So it's a delicate balance. So it's always walking this fine line. My purpose is never to put anybody down. I don't believe that in order to raise women up, we have to cut men down. So I'm there to talk about women's history. Now, you can't do that without talking about the fact that they've been oppressed, you know. But I try to do it in a way that I'm not up there just preaching, you know, at people. And some men are never going to get it. Some men have come to these performances because they've got a gun to their head, basically. Sometimes literally, you know, like when I'm performing for the military. No, I'm just kidding. Nobody ever comes in with a, you know, actual literal gun to their head. But I get invited to perform at a lot of like equity and diversity kinds of programs. And so these are programs where sometimes people feel like they're forced to come. You know, it's a college system, and they're forced to go to, you know, 3 diversity programs a year, and I'm one of the diversity programs. And I have sometimes had men come up to me afterwards and say things like, this isn't as bad as I was expecting. And, you know, that's when you think, oh, okay, I guess this hasn't been going so well. But, you know, so those kind of men, if they come in with a big chip on their shoulder, you know, there's not much I can do. But the biggest response I get is, I would say it's mostly positive. I have men come up afterwards who want to buy the CD for their daughter or their wife, you know, and they, oh, this is just so wonderful what you're doing. So I guess that's a very long answer to what men get out of it is, it depends on the attitude that they bring into it. If they come in with a chip on their shoulder, they're not going to take much away from my program other than feeling like they got beat up all night. But, you know, that's their interpretation. I performed at a folk festival once, and I did one murder ballad. And it's a murder ballad that now about half the songs in white American tradition are murder ballads. And most of the time they're about a young woman who gets killed. And the purpose of these stories was to teach young women the proper way to behave. So, for example, usually she's walking down at the riverside with her boyfriend, and she's not escorted by, you know, an uncle or somebody, and the young man ends up killing her. Well, these were little morality tales. Women kept these songs alive because they were instructing young girls. Don't go walking down the riverside with your boyfriend, because if you do, you're going to get killed and you're going to have nobody to blame but yourself. And so I sang this one murder ballad, and afterwards some guy came up with a scowl on his face and said to me, you know, I hate these feminist things where they make it sound like all men are murderers. And I'm standing there thinking, where from one murder ballad did you get the interpretation that I was saying all men are murderers, you know? So that's a chip that guy had on his shoulder. And oddly enough, not too long after that, I did a performance in a men's medium security prison. And I sat there thinking of that guy saying all men aren't murderers. And I sat there thinking, oh my gosh, I wonder how many people that I'm singing for are. But you know, that program went over fantastically. I got so many nice comments on that program in the men's prison. Mm-hmm. So
if you were going to talk about some of the songs on your CD, which one would be your favorite?
Oh, gosh, that's cruel, because it depends on what day it is. You know, like people say, if you could only sing one song, what would it be? And, you know, it really depends on the mood I'm in, because for me, the music is such a personal expression. So there are songs on my CD that it might be one that I wrote that would be my favorite song. Some of them I wrote, the first song I wrote in the state of Wisconsin is on my CD, and it's called I Wish I Could Fly to the Hills of Kentucky, where I grew up. And so, you know, when it gets to be April and the snow is, you know, up to my chin, that's a song I put on that I like to listen to. Songs that other people wrote, there's a song on there called Evergreen, and that was a song written by a woman named Mary Lou Lane. Sometimes these hills and valleys seem dark as the coal, and it's a song that's a tribute to a real life Norma Rae. I draw my strength from the roots you plant, my friend, you're evergreen. With a tall, straight spine, you never lean, rising upward, evergreen. You know, so that's a song that I just really love. And the first time I heard it, I thought, oh, I've got to learn that song. And you know, some of the songs I've learned because they're illustrative. You know, they work well in my program, but, you know, they're fun to sing in my program, but they're not something that I'd put my headphones on and listen to. Evergreen is one that I would. Another song on there that the first time I heard it, it just knocked my socks off, is Patsy Montana's I Wanna Be a Cowboy Sweetheart. I Wanna Learn to Rope and to Ride. And it's got yodeling in there. And that song, I heard it, and I just, you know, I had to grab my guitar and scribble down the words as I was listening to it so I could learn it. And then I learned that it had a very, you know, interesting history behind it, that in the early days of radio, songs about women had a hard time getting aired because the whole point of radio was to sell stuff. You know, that was the origin of the soap opera. They started out to sell Ivory soap, and the little story would be something like, oh, Johnny has turned into a juvenile delinquent because he's got, you know, dirt on his collar. And then his mother discovers, you know, Ivory soap, and he becomes a priest, you know. And so these little commercials, these little vignettes grew and grew and grew until they became whole storylines. And that's why to this day we call them soap operas. That was the origin of them. But the early days of radio was to sell stuff. And even though there were songs in the folk tradition like Equinoxial and Phoebe, those kind of songs weren't getting on the radio because the middlemen, and that's literally middlemen, you know, the producers on these radio programs, if they would hear a song like Equinoxial and Phoebe, they'd think, well, men aren't going to want to hear that, and we're not going to sell stuff. And in the very early days of radio, that was most of the content. People went into the mountains of Kentucky and West Virginia and down in the South, and they recorded people singing folk songs, and that's what they put on the radio. That predated the era where people wrote songs for the radio. That came later. So that was the first place where a lot of the women's folk songs got lost, because after the 1920s or so, most people learned their culture off the radio. They weren't learning it from each other anymore. They were learning it from pressed records and the radio. And the women's stuff got shunted to the side because there was the belief that their stuff wouldn't sell. I think there was a fairly common belief that things of interest to men would be of interest to men and women, but things that are interesting to women are only interesting to women. And I think that's still true today. The only difference is that now women are seen as, you know, spending. And so there's a reason to appeal to women. But so Patsy Montana wrote this song in 1935, and it is still credited as being the first woman-composed song that made it onto the country airwaves. And it soared to the top of the charts. It sold a million copies in 1935. Now, you know, the middle of the Depression. So selling a million copies would be like, you know, going platinum today. And she opened the door for other country western performers and made the programmers think, oh my goodness, there's a market out there for, you know, a song that's about a woman. Because she's singing, the title is I Want to Be a Cowboy Sweetheart, but I think it's really I Want to Be a Cowboy Sweetheart, because she talks about I want to learn to rope and to ride, I want to ride o'er the plains and the desert, out west of the Great Divide. I want to hear those coyotes howling while the sun sinks into the west. I want to be a cowboy sweetheart. That's the life that I love best. It's a little too early for me to yodel, so I won't go into the yodel and, you know, split everybody's eardrums. But it's just a vibrant, happy, you know, independent song.
Oh, it sure is. Could give the background of Oh Dear, What Can the Matter Be? Because that's our introduction to this program. And I think since you wrote it, you're really in a good place to talk about it. Oh, dear. No, it's not. No, we will not stop. We will not go away.
We will not stop. We will not go away. Yes. All of the songs I write, I never sit down and think, okay, I want to write a song. What can I do? It's something that's kicking around in my head, and then it just comes out. I've described it as giving birth. Every song I've ever written is like a child to me. It just comes out fully formed. In 1983, Equal Rights Amendment was up again. Now, that had been proposed very shortly after women got the right to vote. Alice Paul and the National Women's Party proposed the Equal Rights Amendment, and it's had various forms over the year, but basically all it says is that the rights will not be abridged because or denied because of gender. That's, in its many forms, that's all it has said. And in 1983, it had been ratified by, let's see, I'd get all my numbers straight here. You know, it needed yet another state to be ratified, and it went down to defeat. And that very day, the president of the National Organization of Women was giving a lecture in Green Bay. And so she started off by talking about, you know, the fact that this had gone down to defeat again. And she said, now, the important thing you've got to remember is that suffrage didn't happen overnight. And she talked a bit about the women's suffrage movement. She said, you know, it took 72 years to get that passed. And we've only been working on the ERA. Well, at that time, it would have been, you know, 63 years. And she said, so you can't give up, because the message we've got to send is we will not stop. I start to cry just even thinking about it. We will not stop, and we will not go away. And I came home, as I was driving home, I was just thinking that. We will not stop. We will not go away. And I got thinking of how important it was that she said, you have to know our history. She said, we live in an era where if we don't get things the first time, we give up. And this was in 83, and she was talking about how instantaneous everything was. And she said, we have to have the perspective of history, and we have to know that anything good is worth fighting for. And so I had that song written by the time I got home. I got home, and I was thinking, you know, we will not stop, we will not go away. And then working in the words of 72 years our foremothers fought just to win us our right at the ballot box. But even then they knew that the fight had just begun, and their daughters will not rest until equality is won. And I decided that when I was working on my album that I wanted to put that song on it, and so I brought in a couple of friends of mine, Fawn Keel and Chris Grimes, and they're the ones that you hear singing with me, you know, on that. So that's how that song was born, and I'm just so delighted that, you know, 20 years after that, now you want to use this as the theme for your radio blog. That's really, it's part of this whole cycle of women just keep inspiring each other, and we just keep moving on. You know, step by step, we just keep moving on.
Tell me a little bit about the song Whole People. That's a song.
Oh,
that,
Whole People. Now you have that CD. One that they can listen to, right?
Yes, I do.
Yes, that song. I was performing at an equity conference down in Kentucky, and afterwards, a woman came up to me and said that she dabbled around with songwriting. She said not much. She said mostly just writing poems and then, you know, trying to put some music to it, and would could she send me one of her songs? So I got this tape in the mail, and it was something that she had just, you know, made in the kitchen, and I could hear the dog barking in the background and, you know, the whole thing. But I loved the song, and I called her up, and I said, you have to tell me the story behind this song. And she said she wrote it when her daughter was born. And she said she was at the hospital, and, you know, all the little babies were in the nursery, and all the little girls were dressed in pink and in pink bassinets, and all the little boys were in blue, you know. And she said she was listening to the people, you know, tapping at the window and talking to their grandbaby or whatever behind the glass. And that to the boys, they were saying things like, oh, he's such a big, strong boy. He's going to grow up to be a football player. Or he's going to be. And at the little ones in pink, they were saying, oh, she's so sweet. She's going to be, you know, sugar and spice. And she's going to be. And she said she had intellectually known about, you know, how we create gender differences. But she said that just was one of those life-altering experiences for her, that here were these little blobs in these bassinets. Some are assigned to pink, some are assigned to blue. And she said with nothing else to go on, all of these characteristics were being, you know, laid upon them. And woe to the little pink or blue who grew up to be different than what those expectations were. And she said she wanted her daughter, and then later she had a son. She said what she wanted for them was to just take the best characteristics, whether those were considered male or whether they were considered female. She just wanted them to be the best people, to be whole people. And that she hoped that in their relationships that they would find their mate, you know, whether that was another man, whether that was, you know, a woman, whatever, but that they would find their mate that brought to that relationship the things that they didn't have, you know, and so that together, if they, that first they would become whole people themselves, and then when they were in a relationship, it would be two whole people, you know, not two half people in a relationship. So this was all behind this song that she wrote, that basically starting in that nursery and seeing how so young we're already projecting these gender expectations, and that people who don't fit those gender expectations, you know, end up getting bullied or being derided or whatever, that we just want to be the best people we can be, no matter, you know, what we're born with or what we grow into. So that's a, Beth Stiver wrote that, and I noodled around with it. There's been many times over the years that people have said, oh, I've written this poem, could you set it to music? And I say, I can't do that, because for me, the words and the music are all formed in my head and come out as, you know, one product. But in this case, there was enough of a tune on that tape that I was able to take it and, you know, basically finish the song for her. And she very generously allowed me to record that song. So that's the story behind that.
Well, I'd like to play it now, if that's okay, because we still have
that's
time.
That's great. Yes.
Okay, here we go. Whole People. And would you say her name again, please?
Beth Stiver.
Joined in heart and soul, but that is only part of the goal.
Jerry, that's a great song. I really love it. And
you know,
I found
I
you through
heard
the
that
internet.
In a while.
Oh, well, doesn't it feel good to hear it again?
It does. It does, because I don't pop my CD on and listen to myself. You know, those are always such a long process that by the time you get done with them, it's like, you know, you never want to hear the thing again, because it's a long, painful, and joyful process putting out something like a CD. And but there's so many, you know, technological things involved in doing it. But to just hear the song like that now, so distant from having recorded it, it is a beautiful song that she wrote, and the message behind it. And just as I was listening to it, I was thinking again of how the more things change, the more things stay the same. When I mentioned earlier that there, you know, was a very virulent anti-suffrage movement, just as there was a very virulent anti-ERA movement, and you know, just as you have things going on today that are trying to turn back the clock. The little things are what people focus on, and one of the things I found in the anti-suffrage society in Cincinnati was a little postcard that they used to mail around, and it was a picture of a little girl in bloomers, and so right away they were making a statement, because bloomers, of course, were a symbol of women's liberation. It was a little girl in bloomers, and it said, "I am a little suffragette, but oh, please tell me why. All the boys just look at me, and then they pass me by." So even back at the turn of the century, there was that distinction being made that, oh, people who support suffrage are just these ugly women who can't get men. You know, and we still have that around today. And in that song, that's something that she says, that, you know, if you're smart and strong, will you still date? That's today is still a thing, that, you know, girls are nervous about appearing smarter than boys, because that might turn the boys off. You know, when are we going to get past that? You know, when are we going to get past that? So, oh gosh.
I found you through the internet, and of course it's been, I feel like I've known you forever, ever since we connected, you know, by email and phone, and I just love your website, so I just like people to know about what's on it and all the incredible resources that opened up a whole world for me.
Well, my friends call me Ready Reference, because I've always loved finding information and then connecting other people to it. I call myself an infomaniac, if that's a term. And I'd always had drawers and drawers and drawers full of, you know, all these songs and references and, you know, I mean, bookcases full of books. I have so many, you know, odd little resources in that. And then the internet came along, and it gave me a way to share a lot of this information. So I've had a website since, I believe it's 1998. It's at least 1998, and it might even be earlier. I was trying to track down when I first put up a little web page that, you know, had some information with some of the songs. And it was because I would get letters from people, and I would get phone calls, and they would say, "Do you know where I can find this or that?" And I'd think, if one person was interested in it, there's probably other people who are interested in it. So then I would, you know, put it at my website. And eventually my website evolved. I got a domain name back when you could first do that, and it's creativefolk.com, because I decided that that could be an umbrella for, you know, whatever I might want to do in the future. And so one of the things that I have at the website is, you know, I have reading lists, and I have songs people can download. These suffrage songs that we were talking about, I have a sheet of three songs that people can download as a PDF, because I know that, you know, Women's Equality Day comes around and they think, oh, you know, we're having a luncheon, it would be nice to sing a song. Here's a song, they can pick it up, it says it's to the tune of Auld Lang Syne, you know, people can sing it. So I've always felt like the important thing about women's history was to make resources easily available, you know, that the more easy it is to find it, because I had to really dig to find this stuff, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, going through archives and you know, and now it's out there, people can just Google it and boom, there they've got a suffrage song that they can sing. But another one of the biggest sections of my site is I would get calls around Domestic Violence Awareness Month or Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and people would say, you know, do you have a song that we can do? And so, or I would get emails from radio programmers at college stations, you know, wanting to know, do you know of some recorded songs that we can play during this month? So I started collecting a list, and I posted a list. My first list had like 30 songs. And I thought, well, the important thing is to tell people, you know, where they can get this music. And so I limited it to things that are, you know, recorded, not just songs that are in my head or, you know, in the oral tradition. And so I would put in all the recording information. Well, then people started emailing me and saying, you don't have my favorite song on there. And the long story short is this list, I haven't counted, but the last time I counted it was over 200 songs. And it's annotated, you know, it's got a description of what the song's about. And also, and now you can even download most of these things as MP3. So I have links to that. So that has always been my goal, is to make this, you know, as accessible as possible. And I think I get between, I also have a Black History website, because in my other whole life, I have a master's degree in African American studies. So I also have an entire toolkit that I've created that supports African American studies and African American women's studies. And all told, I get about 500,000 visitors a year between, you know, among the various websites. And the wonderful thing is I never have to worry if I'm running out of paper. I can just keep adding and adding and adding. So that's the website that you're talking about. It's I forget probably half of what's up there. I think it would print out to well over 1,000 pages if anybody ever sat down and did that.
I think this is something that I need to, you know, explore even deeper, because I've only gotten the top layer, and it's kept me busy for a long time. So I think we're getting close to the end, and I want to thank you, Jerry. Your experience is really a good reminder of the levels of strong shoulders in which we stand, and we don't have to dig very far in order to be inspired by our rich culture and history. So I want to say your website again, creativefolk.com, and stay tuned for another program on Votes for Women Salon. Thank you, Jerry. And I'll play the opening again.
Well, 72 years our foremothers fought just to win us our right at the ballot box. But even then they knew that the fight had just begun, and their daughters will not rest until equality is won. We will not stop, we will not go away. We will not stop, we will not go away.